Okay, so it's a little bit of a challenge to try to not only say something interesting, but maybe try to say it in a way that's interesting enough to keep you alert and awake after an awful lot of interesting things have already come our way, and it's getting to be late in the day. But I'm going to try. So this is also a great time to practice a little bit of what Kelly was talking about, you know, bring your attention back here. What I want to talk about is a little bit of what happens inside DBT, what happens in the relationship, although I don't actually talk about it as in the relationship because I think that gets us thinking about rather imprecise qualities of the interpersonal enterprise. And I want to rather talk about specifically what the client or patient is doing and how the therapist responds to that and how that might be similar and different in different therapies and what our data say actually seems to make a difference. So I'm calling this the process of change in DBT. But I want to say, when we ask the question, what makes DBT work, that what I'm talking about is a very small piece of the treatment. Don't forget, as Marcia said this morning, DBT is really a whole comprehensive treatment. It includes a lot of parts, only one of which has to do with the individual therapy piece. And I'm going to talk about one piece of that piece, and absolutely don't want to suggest that those other pieces aren't important. This is a rather fine-grained analysis. I think it's useful, but it occurs in a much larger context that I don't want to neglect. So when we understand DBT outcomes, we're putting it in the context of having multiple functions so that patients have multiple contact points with multiple providers. And there are a lot of different things going on. They're learning skills at a very basic level, acquiring them, strengthening them. They have help in generalizing those skills. There are metaprocesses like dialectics, which turn out maybe they're important across different places, but dialectics is a metaprocess of DBT by itself. Very difficult to study, but it may be that one of the reasons DBT is effective is because it employs dialectics across all these different modes and functions of treatment. Another piece that we might not want to neglect has to do with what I call meta-targeting. For example, emotion regulation is a target across all contact points. So when we're trying to teach skills, they're vis-a-vis emotion regulation. When we're strengthening and generalizing skills, they're vis-a-vis regulating emotion. In the skill training group, it's about regulating emotion. You know, on the consultation team, as Kelly was just talking about, it's about therapists regulating our emotions. So there's a meta target here of emotion regulation. And, of course, there also are specific therapeutic processes. As Katie talked about, there are very specific things that we do in DBT that may be important and other things that may be neutral and other things that actually could be unhelpful. And we have to sort that out. Now, as outcome research goes, of course, DBT is considered well-established. At the moment, it's the only treatment that's considered well-established by the APA, American Psychological Association, criteria, Division 12. It's the only one. That's, by the way, that sounds very partisan. I don't mean it to be. It's just descriptive. I actually hope that more and more treatments are others that come along because DBT by no means helps 100% of people. And clients need access to multiple places they could go. So we're rooting for there to be more treatments that are effective as opposed to DBT to be better than other treatments. We want DBT to be effective, and we want other treatments to be effective too. Now, sometimes, even today in 2011, we hear things about common factors in psychotherapy, that maybe the reason that therapies work is because of so-called common factors, that all, you know, this is the old statement, you know, from Alice in Wonderland that, you know, all have won and all must have prizes. All therapies are equally good. And they all have something to offer. And there may be problems for which that's true, but borderline personality disorder is clearly not one of those sets of problems. And the evidence is rather dramatic to say that. There are different outcomes between, for example, DBT and uncontrolled treatment as usual in the community. Well, that certainly uncontrolled treatment as usual includes some of these common factors, and DBT consistently outperforms. DBT was shown to be better than a validation-only treatment for substance use disorders, better than client-centered psychotherapy, better than expert treatment as usual that Marcia talked about this morning. and more recently better than a manualized object relation psychotherapy for treating BPD. So clearly there are specific factors, and this dodo bird effect, as it's been called, should be extinct. I think that it's not actually common factors that are responsible for these outcomes, and we have to figure out what specifically is going on that makes this therapy effective. Now, one of the things that's cited, and Marcia brought this up, is this issue about relationship qualities between the patient and the... That was interesting. Uh-oh. I just disappeared. That's not good. Okay, the computer went off. I don't know why. Well, shall I talk? You've got the... somebody's coming. I'm just looking to see if everything's plugged in. Well, you've got it on paper, right? No, the computer itself went off. Shall I continue? Because you've got it all on paper, right? Okay. So what you have in front of you now, then, is this little slide about the Working Alliance. The Working Alliance inventory is one of two pretty consistently used inventories to measure the quality of the relationship as perceived by the patient, or sometimes by the therapist. In this case, we're going to look at the patient's perception of this. Now, often it's said, gee, the quality of the alliance is what really matters. If you can get the patient to be secure in the alliance, to like the therapist, to feel liked by the therapist, to feel understood by the therapist, those are some of the things that go into the alliance, that ought to promote outcome, that ought to be a mediator of outcome. In other words, when the alliance is better, outcome should be better. When the alliance is poor, we expect outcomes to be poor. So I want to tell you about a study that we've done, and that's the next. So on the bottom of this page, study basics. So in a study, an outcome study, a randomized controlled trial with 63 young adults from 18 to 25, and they were randomly assigned to either receive DBT, a very standard version of DBT with very minor modifications, but essentially standard DBT, or they received an object relations psychodynamic treatment that was manualized and supervised by the developer of that treatment. The treatments were controlled in the sense that they were up to 12 months long. They included an individual component and a group control component and team consultation for both treatments. So lots of controls here, so it's not just time and attention, it's not supervision. All the assessments were done by independent assessors who were blind to treatment condition. And all the therapists were master's level therapists supervised by experts. Okay? So all decent enough therapists, but by no means super, none of these folks had more than a few years of experience of any kind of psychotherapy and no more than a couple of years of experience within that treatment model. So I think I can go back and try again, huh?
It's running out of batteries. Like this is broken.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to get you set up here.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so if you turn your page, then you'll see the graph, and it shows the Working Alliance inventory. And in the Working Alliance inventory, can you see this on your page? Yeah. Okay. There are two lines, and the top line is the Working Alliance inventory reported on by DBT patients, and the lower line by the psychodynamic patients. And in reality, at each point in time, patients in the DBT condition reported a stronger alliance than patients in the psychodynamic condition. However, I just want to say that the patients in psychodynamic condition actually reported pretty typical alliance scores. So these were not bad scores by any means. And in fact, I want to say the outcomes in the psychodynamic condition were respectable. DBT had better outcomes, significantly better outcomes, but actually the outcomes in the other condition were perfectly respectable according to benchmarks in the literature. Same thing with the Working Alliance score. And so it might be tempting to say, well, gee, see, DBT had better outcomes, DBT has stronger alliance, voila, okay? But not necessarily. I want to go a little deeper than that. So if you look at the next slide, it says main outcomes overall.
Indeed, there is a correlation between, say, for example, suicide attempts and self-injuries on the one hand, and reports on a working alliance score, a score of correlation of minus 0.32. And that means that as the alliance goes up, suicide attempts and self-injury goes down. Okay, that's the minus part. One goes up, the other goes down. On suicidal ideation, the same thing, 0.42. And on depression, the same thing, minus 0.42. But if we take this a little bit further and look at the next slide and say, let's look at those relationships separately by treatment, what you see is that, in fact, all of those combined outcomes were because of the strong relationships between alliance and outcome in the psychodynamic condition, because there really isn't any relationship between alliance and outcome within the DBT condition. Okay, so for example, with suicide attempts and self-injury, a very significant 0.5 relationship for the psychodynamic patients and a very non-significant in the other direction, 0.16, for the non-significant 0.16. Suicidal ideation, 0.71. That's a whopper, okay, between in the psychodynamic condition and plus 0.18, non-significant within DBT. 0.5 for depression and minus 0.5 for the psychodynamic and a minus 0.13 within depression. So, as you can see, you get a very different picture of what the alliance means to outcome if you take a little bit more fine-grained analysis and look at the two treatments separately. And if you just took the combined outcomes, you could confirm what would actually be an incorrect hypothesis. Okay, we'll try this one more time. I've got too many sets of slides is what I have. There we go. Well, yeah, there may be. We'll talk about that. So there are a variety of reasons why this might be. My main point here is to simply note that that it's not just that even within the KBKD condition, there are successes and failures. And within a condition that's got, 33 people, that wasn't responsible for the outcome. That's probably not it. Although there is the possibility that there's a little bit of a ceiling effect. Okay. And we're back to, yay, thank you very much. Okay. So. All right, so what does this mean? So it means that the therapeutic alliance is related to outcomes in the psychodynamic therapy, but not in DBT, even though the alliance is better in DBT than in the psychodynamic psychotherapy. And when you try to do a mediational alliance analysis, the working alliance does not mediate outcomes. Okay, so that means, if we were going to just summarize, what does this mean? That means that in the psychodynamic condition, the alliance can be considered a pathway to the outcome. It actually does work that way, okay? And within DBT, it doesn't seem to. There seems to be a different path, even though the DBT outcomes in general, well, overall, were quite a bit better. So let's consider what is going on. If it's not something non-specific like the alliance, what is going on? Well, one possibility, let's think about what we mean when we say psychotherapy processes, because, sorry, I know this is late in the day, and this is maybe a little bit of technical stuff, but it may be worth picking apart. When we talk about the psychotherapy processes, we sometimes get a little bit messy, a little bit sloppy. And so let's be clear that there are different processes that we mean. When we talk about a therapist process, that's typically the active ingredients or therapeutic mechanisms. That's what the therapist is doing. That's in response to what the client is doing, but it's the therapist's behavior. Those are the things that go into what Katie was talking about, adherence behaviors. The context, the patient does something. My behavior as a therapist, I have an adhering response or a less adhering response. Okay, that's a therapeutic process, the therapist process, a therapeutic mechanism. The patient process is more what we might think of as the intermediate outcomes. Sometimes in the literature, we call those mediators of outcome. I think in DBT, those are what we actually think about as secondary targets, like what the patient is experiencing in the moment, having a big emotional reaction or regulating. Okay. Or doing something, some problem solving. Okay, something there. And, of course, the patient process, the idea is it's not so much that we want to help people get really well regulated in the session. We want them to learn how to regulate and then take that with them out into the world, generalize out into the world. So it's both in session and out of session. It's much easier, of course, to measure what happens in session. We tend to have a videotape of that. We haven't yet figured out how to, although with the internet, maybe we can't follow people around and videotape them in their daily life. That's possible now. And then, of course, we have the patient outcomes, the big outcomes, not the things that happen moment to moment or day to day,
But actually, the big things, like, does the number of suicide attempts go down? Does the suicidal ideation go down? Does getting a job go up? Does keeping a job go up? Does depression go down? Those are our primary targets in DBT. So we have to be careful when we talk about psychotherapy processes, which processes we're particularly and specifically talking about. So one therapeutic mechanism, okay, in other words, one thing that therapists do that I want to talk about today has to do with what I'm going to call the dialectics of validation. Now, you already heard from Marcia that validation is an acceptance strategy. And, of course, in general, I would certainly agree with that. But I think that when you get deeper into DBT, you see that validation is an acceptance strategy when we validate, but that actually, of course, we don't validate everything because everything isn't valid. So there are actually some dialectical processes there, like sometimes we invalidate things. Hopefully, we don't invalidate things that are valid. That would be invalidating. But what do you call it when you invalidate the invalid? You call that change. Right? Isn't that what we want to change? It didn't work, we want to change it. That's invalidating the invalid. So I'm not so sure that invalidating the invalid is such a bad thing, except that anytime we invalid, it actually has a, what effect does it have on your emotional arousal? Right, exactly. It goes up. So, but of course, somebody along the way taught me that I should be a scientist and I shouldn't believe these things unless we study them. So we studied it, okay? A doctoral student of mine, Chad Schenck, and I, this was Chad's dissertation, decided to see, in fact, what happens when you validate versus invalidate somebody. And so we, okay, you get to be a psychology professor, you can do stuff like this, okay? My grandmother would say, if she were alive, which she's not, she would have said, you get paid to do this? And then she would have said, I could have told you that. And of course she would have been right. Wise grandmother. But it's science. We can't necessarily believe my grandmother. So we stress people out. These are all volunteers. This is the first study, and we've actually replicated this with including with a high BPD sample, comparing to a low BPD. But for now, our purposes, this is all that matters. You know, we stress people out. The stressor here is we just give them some simple-looking math problems that are actually hard to do. Okay? Turns out that our brains tend to add across or up and down. And then if you give them lines, different three lines of math problems across, okay, then our brains get confused. We can't do it so well. And you time them, okay, and you can't get the right answer. And it's frustrating. Okay? Plus, of course, if anybody got the right answer, we told them it was the wrong answer. So, but it turns out nobody got the right answer. But so we didn't actually have to. But the idea is not to, the idea is to frustrate them. And they all volunteered for a study in which they would be frustrated. They knew it was we were looking at the effects of stress and frustration. Okay, so they knew that. What they didn't know is that when they got frustrated, they were randomly assigned to either be validated or invalidated about their experience. Okay, not their performance, their experience. So in the validating condition, at the peak of this, okay, all the way at the top, the experimenter would say, okay, we'd stop. Okay, if the person's gotten three, wrong answer. The experimenter would say, stop, put the thing down, say, okay, so how's it going? And invariably, the subject would say something like, I don't like this. This is harder than I thought. This is frustrating. I feel stupid. All kinds of things like that. And in the validating condition, the experimenter would maintain good eye contact and kind of nod, look serious, and say, nod. Okay, so, oh, yeah, of course you feel frustrated. Everybody gets frustrated. It's supposed to be frustrating. You know, not all those in the sequence, but one of those and another of those, and then the person would talk a little more, and they say, yeah, of course, everybody has this experience. Don't forget, you signed up. It's designed to be this way. Okay, and then give them three more math problems that they got wrong. Right? And look what happens on the green bar. They get more frustrating tasks, more stressful tasks, and their arousal comes down despite getting the frustrating, stressful tasks. Okay? In the invalidating condition, the experimenter asks the same question, okay? And then when the person says, well, gee, this is hard, okay, the experimenter briefly looks away, looks down, okay? Looks back up, says, huh. Kind of makes a face, crunches up the nose. Huh. Most people don't react that way. Okay? Now notice this has nothing to do with performance. Everybody gets them all wrong. Okay? It's got to do with their experience in that moment, their emotion. Okay? And then, of course, they get three more. They get invalidated again, poor sods. Okay? And look what happens. They don't habituate. They can't. They actually can't come down. Their arousal stays up high. Okay? This makes sense? So, now we have replicated this with a high BPD and compared it to a normative control sample. Looks pretty much the same. In this particular study, this is kind of a cartoon because we had a number of different indices for arousal. We had both psychophysiological measures, galvanic skin response, heart rate, reactivity, respiration, and also self-reports of emotional intensity. They all pretty much correlated, so this is a kind of cartoon slide. All right, so what does that mean? That means that even when we... That means that invalidation does exactly what my grandmother would have predicted. And what you know, too, okay? If you don't believe me, if you don't believe the data, go home, okay? And the next time somebody discloses, like, I feel X, just look at them, scrunch up your nose and say, that doesn't make any sense, and see what happens, okay?
But don't send me an email complaining about it, okay?
Because I'm predicting what will happen. So if we... So here's the cartoon version. See, I don't know if you're familiar with Dilbert. So Dilbert's mother says, "How's work, Dilbert?" And he says, "Well, Mom, I'm like a fly stuck in a thick tar of despair. I'm drowning, and monkeys dressed as lifeguards are throwing me anvils. I long for the comfort of the grave." And she says, "Next time, just say it's fine." Now, I have to say, this is maybe a little extreme, but what Kelly was talking about a little bit ago is can be actually what we're communicating when the person has a lot of intense suffering. Maybe we aren't as blatant as therapists as saying, next time just say it's fine, but we can certainly communicate our own discomfort with their suffering, and that can have quite the same effect. And so I think it's important to ask, well, what happens when we validate instead, if we can get ourselves to validate? So, if we understand validation in DBT, I want to be clear that validation isn't the same as support. I would say good validation is supportive, but I'm not sure that it is the same as, in fact, I'm pretty sure it's not the same as support. We've done some coding with family interactions and people using ordinary ways of coding support, and they correlate, kind of medium correlate, but they're not the same. There are things that we call validating that are not considered very supportive, and things that are supportive that actually aren't considered very validating. Validation certainly often can be warm, but it may not be warm at all. It has multiple functions. Validation, for those of you who are thinking like behaviorists, you might be thinking validation is a reinforcer. Well, sometimes. But sometimes it's an antecedent, too. Sometimes it has eliciting properties. It's a, it can be an it can be a discriminative stimulus, or it can be a variety of other technical things I don't need to go into, like an establishing operation, a variety of things. So it has multiple functions, and it's not nonspecific. At least that's our hypothesis, that it's not nonspecific. It's not like you think, gee, everybody can validate. It's actually a little harder than that. And I think Kelly's example was nice because sometimes the person presents with a rather complex situation, complex emotion, some of which makes sense in one way but not sense in another. Another part makes sense in a different way. It's actually a mishmash of things that are valid in different ways and maybe even some invalid parts. So it's actually nonspecific. It's not just like agreeing and saying, yes, of course you feel that way, right? So I'll give you some examples. So it may be, and that the part of the theory that we're testing in this study that I'm telling you about is that maybe the temporal sequences matter. Maybe what we validate and when we validate and how we validate matter. Okay, so you've got to say this really fast three times. Validate the valid in the way that it's valid, without validating the invalid and without invalidating the valid. And, of course, I want to add that you can sometimes invalidate the invalid if you validate the valid first to soothe, but not do it, but you have to know that. Yeah, very clear. Okay. So validating of the valid, okay, that's acceptance. Okay, what you say, you know, so if I say, gosh, you know, I don't know, when I said my grandmother was dead, okay, this is, you know, she was in her 80s, it was a long time ago. But I say, oh, my poor grandmother died, you say, oh, right, you know, it's sad. Okay, that's probably validating the valid, right? I told you I loved my grandmother, I thought she was kind of a wise woman, as well as having a good sense of humor, that maybe she wasn't so aware of, but she was still pretty funny. So, okay, it's kind of sad, validating the valid. Okay,
That's fair enough. That's an acceptance. Okay? But sometimes we have to invalidate the invalid. Okay, so if I say, so for example, recently had a client who said who had met a new friend or somebody that she wanted to be friends with, and had this plan for inviting this friend to do, had really kind of mapped out the next several days of how she was going to get this new friend that she had just met the laundry, literally that morning before I saw her, and how she was going to get her to have breakfast with her the next day, and then they were going to go do this activity in the afternoon and probably have dinner together, and okay. You with me? And then the next day, maybe they could start having breakfast together every day, and maybe actually if it worked out, maybe next week if her lease is up, maybe they could move in together. And I'm actually not really exaggerating, okay? Now, so, you see that what's not valid about this? It's unlikely to work, right? It's just as a plan. It's probably not going to work. I mean, maybe she found somebody who's as intensely interested in this kind of rapid affiliation as she is, but that's highly unlikely. Okay? What's valid about it? Her desire, her loneliness, that if this could happen, her life would be a lot better. Okay? So there's a lot of valid parts. And there's a lot of there's at least one big invalid part. So if you wanted to talk to her as a therapist or as a sister or as a parent, whatever, you could just simply point out that, you know, that's not going to work. And from our previous slide, But from the previous slide, what happens to your arousal when you say that? Yeah, it's hard to hear. It's invalidating, even though it's invalidating the invalid. So maybe it makes more sense to talk about how that makes sense, that she found somebody she really likes, and of course she'd want to hang out with somebody that seems to like her, and that makes a lot of sense, and this might soothe her loneliness in a big way. Okay, so now you're feeling understood, and I completely am with you. I want you to not be so lonely. I want you to have friends and people who love you too, and I'm not sure that this is the way that's going to work. So at the end of a lot of validating comes the invalidating. Does that make sense? Okay, that's the dialectics of validation, I think. The same behavior has both valid and invalid parts. Now, of course, if you parse it, they're different behaviors, okay? The desire is different from the plan. But at that moment, they're part of the same report. They're part of the same dump on the table, okay? Or it's kind of valid in one way but not another. But there's always, and we say this in our Family Connections program, behavior is always valid in some way. It's not always apparent why it's valid, but it's always valid in some way. Our job is to figure out in what way it's valid, in what way it does make sense, at least given this person's experience, and maybe even normatively. And so behavior is always valid in some way, maybe simply ontologically, maybe just because that's what the person wants or experiences, just prima facie, it's valid. Maybe it's valid in a limited way because of the person's own history, because of its meaning for that person in his or her history, okay? Or given the problems that he or she has, okay? But maybe it's just normative. Of course, anybody would think or feel or want, right? I mean, honestly, for my patient I was telling you about, you meet somebody that you really like, of course you want to spend more time with them. There's an of course there, isn't there? That's not pathological. That's not because she's been given a diagnosis of BPD. That's because she's a human being. She's a member of the species. And so you got to find that piece to hang on to, as opposed to, and Kelly could help us, slow down and not just jump on, you know that's not going to work. Maybe that's not the most therapeutic way to approach that, is with the invalidating part first. Okay? And, as Marcia said this morning, sometimes things are valid just because they're more effective that way. Maybe it makes more sense to, what was it, to get on the plane, to sort of just be effective and not complain, because that's not going to work. Maybe it's more effective. It may be valid to complain. You may have a right to complain, and that's going to get you delayed for an extra couple of days or years. Okay, now we can think about validating responses in one way as shaping or reinforcement. In DBT, DBT is a behavior therapist, so that's a relevant piece, and that's a part of it. And when we validate, of course, we are saying, gee, that makes sense in some way.
We can also block and redirect. That's shaping. Okay, block and redirect. That's a good plan, and that's a totally legitimate desire, and I'm not sure that plan's going to get you what you want. Okay, block. That's yes and. Okay, validation can be an eliciting stimulus for the behaviorists among you. You know, think about discriminative stimulus that get you the person to do something, or S deltas, things that like a phone that's not ringing, which you don't usually answer. Right? It calls for not answering it. Okay, the non-behavior. So validation can be thought of as a kind of discrimination training. It fosters a kind of mindfulness and awareness and acceptance of something as working in context, and therefore fosters emotion regulation. So we might put it together this way. So in a psychotherapy session, DBT, the patient expresses some emotion. Okay. Now that emotion may not be completely clear. It may be, as Kelly talked about, quite a mix of things going on at the same time. And the therapist responds. Okay, the therapist responds in some way. Doesn't have to be validating in this example, but the therapist does something in response to that. Okay, and that may have an impact on immediate expression of the emotion in the session. Okay, that may actually change something down the road to contribute to outcomes. Or it may help the person express something different, experience and express it differently outside the session. Okay, which then has an impact on outcomes. So that's the general idea. Things happen both in the session that directly affect outcomes, but probably more likely have to get working in the person's life before they actually have a big effect on outcomes. Now, pardon me, Marcia, but I think the DBT does treat something that we might call crap. Sorry, I didn't intend to make up acronyms. She said you loved acronyms, and I didn't intend to use this acronym. I didn't start this. I kept talking about the chronic regulation of affect problems. I kept talking about that, and somebody finally said to me, that's a bunch of crap, and I felt a little defensive. And I said, what do you mean, chronic regulation of affect problems? Okay, we teach crap, teach crap. Yeah. That's what we do. The pervasive dysfunction of the emotion regulation system. This is what we're after all the time, is helping people regulate. Right? That's it. That's there. All the time. So one of the key processes, one of them, not the only one, I think has to do with discriminating primary from secondary emotions. And for those of you not familiar with this particular way of thinking about things, primary emotions are the, without reconditioning, okay, they are the natural initial response. They're normative and typically adaptive and effective. Okay, so when I said, you know, my grandmother died, you could say, oh, you know that the primary emotion would be sadness. Okay, so in the face of death and loss, it would be sadness and grief. Okay, if I tell you anywhere on the planet, I say somebody's chasing, I give you a story, somebody's chasing somebody with a stick, trying to harm them, that person feels afraid, right, and so forth and so on. So those are primary emotions. And secondary emotions, there are a couple of ways to get there, but secondary emotions are emotional responses to the primary emotion. Okay, they're kind of, think of them as escape responses, alternatives, and they could be culturally shaped up, right? Like if you're driving along and somebody cuts you off, how do you feel? How many people feel angry? Okay, now I have to say, if we pluck somebody who'd never seen a car, okay, out of a little culture, a little place, a little deserted island, who'd never seen a car, you put them in a car, moving along at 60 miles an hour, somebody cuts out in front and comes within an inch of having an accident, I am willing to bet you a lot of money they don't feel angry. I bet they feel fear. Right. So we'd have to say fear might be the primary emotion, but through lots of conditioning over time, social, cultural, individual, and modeling, that changes, and that's a secondary emotion. It's an emotional response to that. It can also be mediated by judgments, which are a mindfulness kind of thing. If the person says, see, that's wrong, that's bad, that transforms the primary emotion into something else. It's usually, if it's wrong and bad about you, then it elicits more anger towards the other person. If it's wrong and bad about me, it elicits more shame about me. And so something that I might feel sad about, instead I feel ashamed about, or that I might feel sad about, I might feel angry about. Anyway, so one of the key things that we do in DBT is try to help people sort this piece out. Because, in fact, primary emotions almost always are the emotion to accept. Sometimes they're so intense you have to change the intensity, but not the quality. Secondary emotions themselves, we want to accept them, but we also don't want to ignore the fact that there was a primary emotion that's being missed. So we actually almost always want to change the secondary emotion. Get the person back to the primary emotion. Okay? So we could say that primary emotions
are not yet dysregulated, at least when they start. They're an initial reaction to something that happens, you know. So if I go to work,
and my friend at work is on the phone, but I really want to tell him or her something, and they're on the phone, I can't talk to them, then I feel a little disappointed. I say a little disappointed. I mean, if it's really important, I might feel a lot disappointed. I could feel a little frustrated, too, or there's a lot of things I could feel. But those would be primary emotions. Okay? They're not yet dysregulated. They're valid normatively. They're more accurate. Their expression is more accurate. It's easier to understand primary emotions because when I give you the scenario, everybody says the same thing, right? I say, gee, somebody's grandmother dies. They like their grandmother. It's sad. Everybody knows that. So it's easier to validate a primary emotion. It's easier to manage a primary emotion because there's more help. Secondary emotions, I would say dysregulated emotions are secondary emotions. That doesn't mean all secondary emotions are dysregulated. It just means that dysregulated emotions are typically secondary. Primary emotions can be dysregulated too. That can't happen. But it's more difficult to regulate secondary emotions, partly because they're less accurate expressions of connecting the emotion with what actually happened in the moment. They're harder to understand, so there's less help managing. There's less likelihood of a natural and easy thing to validate. So identifying, allowing, and self-validating and managing primary emotions is a central process in self-management. I would say this is a big part of what, even if you've, for people who've never heard of DBT, even if they don't use this language, I would say in psychotherapy, this would be something that lots of therapies would say, have to tweak the language a little bit, but I'm not sure this is a terribly controversial thing I'm saying. Okay? But it's very precise about the description in DBT. So let's look at treatment outcomes for context. So this is back to the study I told you about, our comparison of DBT to psychodynamic treatment. Just for context, this is suicidality on the suicide behavior questionnaire, which is a questionnaire that Marcia and others developed. And as you can see, patients in PDP is psychodynamic psychotherapy, and DBT is DBT. The psychodynamic therapy, the folks came down, but not as much as they did in DBT. This is up to 12 months of treatment, and then the follow-up is 6 months later. So as you can see, better outcomes in DBT here. On the Beck Depression Inventory, patients in the DBT condition are starting at about 35, about 31 in the psychodynamic condition. In the DBT condition, ending up below 10, which is in the normative range, actually pretty good outcomes. And again, nice outcomes with the psychodynamic condition with a mean of about 16, so down about 15 points. But DBT, all these differences are significant, by the way. And in terms of global assessment of functioning, both conditions starting around 50 and the psychodynamic ending up just below 65 and the DBT ending up just above 75. So again, significantly better outcomes. Now the point of this is this talk today is not the outcomes, but how we're getting to those outcomes, what we're actually doing that's contributing to those outcomes. Now, one thing that you can do and that we've done and others have done is try to do mediational analyses. What are the patient processes that contribute to the patient processes in the moment that happen, say, in the first half of therapy that contribute to outcomes later on. And mediation analyses actually help quite a bit. Start to talk about things, but they are limited, often by reliance on self-report, which, because then you have this sort of problem of method, this sort of mono-method bias. They're often weak inference tests. They're not often compared to other possible mediators, so they kind of stand alone. We find that when we test different mediators separately, they can all be significant, and they actually correlate with each other, and they're kind of hard to tease out, therefore, what the mediators actually are. And their alternate explanations are difficult to rule out because of that. They also don't make a distinction between the direct in-session effects and the indirect out-of-session effects, what's being generalized versus what's not. A lot of mediators covary, which makes it a little muddy about what's actually going on. Does not identify what are the treatments leading to patient changes. Okay, so what are some alternatives? Well, let's look at this therapist-client process around validating. So how can a therapist respond when a patient expresses something emotional? And expresses could be verbally, like I feel X, or expresses it nonverbally by having a face that expresses X, or a story that actually, just like telling you, gee, somebody was chasing me around with a stick trying to harm me, that's expressing some emotion too. You could kind of know what's going on there.
So one possibility is to validate fully. Okay, it makes perfect sense if you feel that way. In DBT, we tend to call that a level 5 validation. That's normalizing the emotion. You could validate minimally. You kind of reflect back or acknowledge it. So you felt sad. Okay, the person says, yeah, I felt really sad. You say, yeah, okay, yeah, you look sad, or yeah, you felt sad. Level 2 in DBT language. You could also fail to validate. You could do nothing. That doesn't mean you ignore it. It just means that you don't validate. You might be paying a lot of attention to it, but you're not communicating anything about it. You could also block it and redirect. You could say, well, what about? And so sort of like, okay, I don't want you to go in that direction. I want you to go in this direction with the emotion. Okay? And I think therapists do that a lot, especially when somebody escalates. You know, we sort of want to block and redirect sometimes. Therapists can actually invalidate. I used to think, gee, I don't think therapists do this much, but actually after watching tapes, I think therapists do this. And not necessarily bad or ineffective. But, you know, it doesn't make sense that you're feeling that way. And part of the question, of course, is what precedes that statement. Okay? It makes sense that you really want to affiliate with this person you just met who seems to like you and you're so lonely, and I'm not sure that's a good plan. Okay, now the plan is concrete. It's not invalidating the emotion, but nevertheless. And that's the dialectical validation, that one part is valid in one way while another part's not so valid, is not valid, or another part is valid in a different way. The dialectical part is really parsing that. So perhaps the therapist's response should depend on the patient's accurate expression. Maybe we need to make sure we're responding to the accurate part, the primary emotion. That was our hypothesis anyway. Because otherwise we end up like this guy. Sit up and let me stamp your forehead. I'm here to validate you. It's kind of non-contingent. It's kind of like you are a good person, a whole person, and darn it, people like you. It's the, what was the guy's name? He's now the Al Franken version of psychotherapy. Right, the something Smiley, Stuart Smiley version of psychotherapy. All right, so we created a coding system, the details of which I don't want to go into, just for time, and we randomly picked out a couple of sessions from each therapist-client dyad and that was available. They were coded by, we call them blind coders, which is kind of funny. Of course, they aren't blind. They're blind to other things about the patients. They don't know anything about the patients. They don't know what condition they're in. They don't know what time of therapy they're in. They don't know what kind of problems they have. We code for reliability. The reliability was actually pretty good. It was actually very good. And for the patient, we were interested in the expression of emotion. Did they generally express emotion? We couldn't tell whether it was primary or secondary, just general expression. And then sometimes we could actually tell from the context, from the story they'd tell, that it was a primary emotion. And sometimes we could tell from the context and the story they'd tell that it was a secondary emotion. If we could tell, we'd label it a primary or secondary. If we couldn't tell, it was ambiguous, we'd call it a general emotion. So nothing, you know, and it actually turns out that a lot of these things are just general. We really can't tell from context. But when we could tell primary and secondary, we've tried to code them that way. And for the therapist, of course, we used Marsha's system for thinking about how, the different ways that we validate, different kinds of validation, as well as failing to validate, okay, missing the opportunity when an emotion is expressed, as well as blocking self-invalidation, like, I shouldn't feel this way. I shouldn't, like if this woman said to me, you know, I shouldn't want to spend so much time with this new friend. Well, in DBT, I think there'd be a premium on blocking that self-invalidation because, in fact, it makes sense that she'd want to spend that much time with somebody who likes her. It actually does make sense. Maybe her plan isn't effective, but it makes sense why she'd want to have that plan. And redirect back to the primary emotion. The primary emotion would be, I do want it. That's just the reality. I do want it. I'm lonely, and I want to have, I want to affiliate with somebody who's nice to me and somebody who likes me. And then there's dialectical validation, you know, level 2, secondary. Okay, that's like when she, if she said, I'm such a bad person, there's something really wrong with me, I shouldn't want this much closeness with somebody, then I'm broken, okay? So the V2 there, that's a secondary, that shame about it is a secondary emotion. Can you see that? There's nothing inherently shameful about wanting to affiliate with somebody that you like and who likes you. It's actually quite an adaptive response, quite a normative response, quite a valid primary emotion. And if she said that, we'd want to block it, in DBT anyway. We'd want to say, okay, but the V2 is, I know that you're judging yourself right now. Okay, so we validate what's valid. Okay, you are judging yourself, and when you judge yourself, you feel a lot of shame. Okay, and then we go on to, it makes a lot of sense that you'd want to affiliate with this person. You're pretty lonely, and this person's pretty nice, and you know, so forth and so on. Does this make sense? Okay. So let's just quickly. I'm not going to give you any numbers because just go with the, trust me. The numbers on this are I'm showing you the stuff that I'll tell you what's significantly there and what isn't. So if you just look at base rates, like gee, all kinds of validating responses in all situations, you find out that the psychodynamic therapists are just as validating as the DBT therapists. Plenty of validation. Actually, surprisingly, not that much validation for either. I was shocked at how relatively modest the amount of validation was. We're working on that in my team right now. But there, the difference is there are actually essentially no differences. It wasn't a power problem. I mean, really, they were validating at very similar levels. So if you just look at it in terms of base rates, you'd say, gee, that's a nonspecific effect. All of one, almost have prizes, right? They're all good. They're all validating. That's nice. But let's think about the kinds of validation that were. DBT therapists were much more likely, 8 times more likely, to validate using level 5. 8 times more likely to use a level 5 validation. That's the normative. It makes perfect sense that you feel this way. To find the primary emotion, to find the normative piece, and validate that in a normative, non-pathological way. That's a dramatic finding. That's obviously significant. In terms of missed opportunities to validate, the psychodynamic therapist missed twice as many opportunities to validate primary emotions. And we didn't look at missing opportunities to validate secondary emotions because that's a little more complicated. And they missed twice as many opportunities to block secondary emotions and redirect to primary emotions. Okay, that idea of like, I know you're feeling really ashamed of yourself right now, and let's think about like how reasonable it is for you to want to affiliate with this person. Okay, that's blocking and redirecting back to the normative primary emotion to validate that. So they missed more opportunities to do that. And psychodynamically, logically, if overall the two groups are validating the same amount, the psychodynamic therapist must be validating something, and they're more likely to validate secondary emotions. In other words, I think within this particular treatment, and by the way, this is not a criticism of psychodynamic therapy, right? I mean, they were doing their treatment, and if we were going to think about, gee, if they were going to construct a study, they'd look at the kinds of things that they're supposed to do. So I don't mean this in the slightest bit of a critical way against the treatment. It's really understanding inside DBT what's going on that matters in DBT. So in other words, the DBT therapist seemed to be discriminating between primary and secondary emotions, and the psychodynamic therapist did not seem to be making that discrimination overall. That would be like sort of my take home. DBT therapists were much more likely to use dialectical validation. Block secondary things, block the invalid, and at the same breath, validate the valid. Sometimes in either order, but they were more likely, if you look at it sequentially, either way to do that, and they were much more likely to block secondary emotions and to redirect to primary emotions. So, now connecting this to outcomes is the tricky part, but it turns out that missed opportunities to validate, dialectical validation, blocking secondary and redirecting, and validating at level 5 are all correlated to outcome. So these things are, in DBT at least, relevant predictors of outcomes. So if we're DBT therapists and we want to get good outcomes, we've really got to work on doing these kinds of things. In other words, I think it's a way of validating, if you will, sorry, I don't have another word to use, in the scientific sense, validating the model in a way, I think. Emotion regulation, okay, the difficulties in emotion regulation scale, DBT folks, of course, are coming down faster and in a more enduring way than in the psychodynamic condition. And this is a mediator of outcome. This is a significant mediator of outcome for the whole study. And those 5 variables I just showed you are correlated with the DERS scores along the way. Now, we can't do more fine-grained analyses right now, but just because this is a kind of bootstrap study. And in order to be able to see what happens first along the way, we'd have to actually code a lot more sessions, and it's rather laborious. And we'd have to have more, we'd probably have enough DERS scores, but we'd have to have a lot of sessions, a couple of sessions in between each DERS administration to do a more fine-grained analysis. So if anybody's got about $50,000, I can do that study. But otherwise, I think we're stuck with what we've got for the moment. So, summary.
the importance of looking beyond base rates to sequences of patient-therapist and therapist-patient behaviors. Okay, both ways. Sequences, what the therapist does that elicits something different in the patient, but also what the patient does that and how the therapist responds to that in a validating or a blocking or some other way. Now, timing and type of validation delivered seem to make a difference in DBT. Timing and type of validation matter, and that the type of validation should match the type of emotional expression. So make a distinction between primary and secondary emotions, and we should validate, should meaning it's going to be more effective to validate primary emotions in a more full way, like a V5 way, and secondary emotions in a more V2 way. And that blocking emotionally dysfunctional processes may actually be associated with increased alliance, not decreased. What does this mean? Well, one way to understand those therapeutic alliance scores I showed you way back in the beginning is that what builds the alliance may not simply be warmth and support and love, although that's pretty good, but it actually might be not treating the person as fragile and being able to say, well, that makes sense, and this piece doesn't. Yeah, you know what? I completely get your wanting to affiliate and how lonely you are. I care enough about that, and I'm serious enough about that to tell you that I don't think this plan is going to work. Let's come up with a different plan that's going to get you what you want. As opposed to, and I don't mean to be making a straw person out of any other therapy, but as opposed to what probably would have happened, this is not what happened in our coding, but as opposed to maybe not being so determined to validate the primary emotion and then problem solve an alternative solution to it. I think that this is good evidence that we have to look carefully at specific and unique therapeutic processes. And they have to be linked to specific in-session patient behaviors. Then those have to be linked to generalized changes outside the session. Okay? And then those changes have to be linked to primary outcomes. And I think we're starting to do that. This kind of study gives us a little bit of a hint each step of those. We need a lot more studies. This is just one little process with one set of hypotheses. There may be many processes that converge. There may be a confluence of things that we call slightly different things that actually come together, and we have to sort out what that set of things are that are leading in the direction of good outcomes and sort them from the set of different things that actually lead astray, that lead to worse outcomes. So there's a lot more work to do. There might be a lot of these processes, a lot of mechanisms that have to be identified. And which ones improve outcomes more? That's where we want to, of course, enhance our treatments. We know which ones are the biggest bang for the buck. We want to do more of those. And as we do, as Katie mentioned, and as Marcia mentioned, the therapy has to be alive. It has to be responsive. And as we find these things out, then the definition of what DBT is changes just a little bit, and then adherence to DBT changes with it. And the rest is under construction. Thanks very much.